Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Coming up, I'm going to talk with Ken Jennings, who's written a new book called Planet Funny, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. I hope you can stay tuned for that. Our top story today is that Microsoft is spending $7.5 billion to buy itself a software development platform called GitHub. It is one of the biggest acquisitions in the history of Microsoft, and that's saying a lot. So we've got GeekWire's Todd Bishop here to explain. This is Seattle's tech news site. Todd Bishop's the co-founder. Welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
What is GitHub?
GitHub is a software development platform and community, which is really the strong selling point for GitHub. It's where
the community part.
A lot of developers connect and share code, and because of that, it's really instrumental in the open source world. And it's a San Francisco-based company. It actually is a privately held company, so it's not unusual that Microsoft would try to acquire it.
Can I ask you, what do you mean when developers connect and share code? In very basic terms, what does that mean?
The instructions for commanding a device or a computer, all of that requires software code, and this is where developers can save code. They can do what's called version control to make sure they're not overwriting each other if they're working on a project together. And it's really a place for them to show off their work, share their work, and store their work. And because of that, it's a place where millions of them gather, and 28 million developers use GitHub, and because of that, it's a key audience for Microsoft. These are the people that are writing the programs inside companies and out in the world that all of us use.
You compared it to LinkedIn.
Exactly. In a lot of ways, it is like a LinkedIn for software developers, in that a developer's GitHub profile can often be kind of a calling card, a resume to show the work that he or she does. And because of that, it can be a place where they can essentially show off the work that they do.
Okay, so millions and millions of developers have been connecting, sharing their code, everything you described, without Microsoft owning it. Why does Microsoft want to buy GitHub now?
Microsoft, over the long term, needs to court this new generation of developers to use things like Microsoft Azure, all of its cloud services. So this is a new connection for Microsoft to these developers.
These developers don't have enough incentive to write for Azure?
No, because Amazon Web Services, if you look at the public cloud infrastructure market, really the servers that run a lot of the services that we use, the big computers in the cloud, as it were, in the data centers in Quincy specifically,
yeah.
Amazon Web Services is the public cloud leader. So Microsoft really does need to improve its position in that market long term. But more than that, Microsoft's real strength, and I think you've seen Satya Nadella really double down on this since he's become CEO, is in big companies and small companies and medium-sized companies rather than consumers. This is where Microsoft really has excelled historically. And with that, so many companies are becoming software development shops unto themselves. Even if they're not tech companies, they have IT departments that are increasingly building code and writing programs. And this then, in acquiring GitHub, is a way for Microsoft to also get inroads into those companies and into new audiences inside those companies that are otherwise its customers.
Okay, so if I'm at a dinner party this weekend and someone says, hey, Bill, you're on NPR, you know, you're on KOW, just in a sentence, why did Microsoft buy GitHub? Just boil it down for me. Microsoft gets what out of the $7.5 billion?
A new connection to a key audience for its future, and really a chance to make those folks in the Microsoft fold and make sure they're in the Microsoft fold long term.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Satya Nadella. This seems to be a change in Microsoft's thinking, because they used to think of this open source, you know, anybody can get in and write it, that was a problem. Steve Ballmer said Linux is a cancer. So what does this move tell you about where Satya Nadella is taking Microsoft?
This is the latest step by Satya Nadella and by Microsoft to embrace open source technologies for real. In the past, they used that word embrace as kind of a bit of a misnomer, and it was basically embrace, extend, and extinguish. I think were the three E's of Microsoft.
Now, hug it tight, suffocate it.
Exactly. Now they clearly are showing that they are on board with open source technologies. They've open sourced a lot of their own code. Now, they haven't yet fully open sourced Windows or Office, but the whole idea is you put the code out there, you let people share it, distribute it, and essentially this becomes the shared asset of the community when you're doing open source. And so this to me is the biggest sign yet that Microsoft sees open source technologies as a key part of the future, this acquisition of GitHub.
But I'm seeing online that some developers don't like this purchase, and why is that?
There is a lot of concern about any one large company controlling such a key part of the software development pipeline. So if you're a developer and you think that Microsoft is evil, which a lot of developers out there still do, especially if they grew up on Linux or developing for other kinds of competitive platforms, you're concerned about any big company acquiring this, especially one with Microsoft's past. And one thing that Satya Nadella said this morning was he hopes that those developers, that the GitHub community, will judge Microsoft based on its recent actions and its future actions. And so that really is the pitch that they're making to this community.
So what about those of us who are not developers? Why should we care? How does this affect the rest of us?
If you care about having multiple strong, large technology companies in the Seattle region, that is one reason to care about this. I think if Microsoft pulls off the GitHub acquisition in the way that it hopes to, keeping it at arm's length, allowing it to operate independently, but ultimately using it as an advantage in the cloud, if you care about those things in the Seattle region, this at least has the potential to keep Microsoft relevant. Interesting point, Microsoft last week surpassed $100 a share for the first time in its history. And you know, they've got more than $100 billion in cash. And one interesting thing here is that they are doing this $7.5 billion acquisition of GitHub in all stock. So this is an example of where Microsoft's strength allows the company to have the financial resources and the Wall Street clout to pull off a big acquisition like this. And you know, though they've made some cutbacks, they are still a very large employer here in the Seattle region.
Okay, maybe keeping Microsoft relevant, whether some developers like it or not. And from Seattle's tech news site, GeekWire, that's co-founder Todd Bishop filling you in on this big announcement. Todd, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. We'll be back in just a moment. This is KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. When I was a kid, I thought comedy was king in America. We watched TV sitcoms. We had Bill Cosby records and Saturday Night Live and Airplane and Steve Martin. Comedy was popular, but it was a genre of entertainment. Now comedy is just the default. Commercials are funny. Viral videos are funny. Twitter is funny. The airplane pre-flight safety check is funny. Even the Seattle Police Department has a funny blog. How has all of this humor changed, and how is humor culture changing us? My guest has written a new book called Planet Funny, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. Ken Jennings, good to see you again.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. What did I cover it? What's another good example of how we experience comedy where we didn't used to? I want to make, because the book lays the case out.
Right.
But convince me if I'm going, you know, I think about things besides comedy, Ken Jennings. What do you mean it's taken over our culture?
You know, one of the big cultural cases is just how it's our, you know, comedians are kind of our default role models. The way young people used to have bands, now they join improv classes or sketch groups. That's kind of your rite of passage of how to be a person. And as far as just how it appears everywhere, I mean, I think of church marquees. Church marquees used to have Bible verses on them.
Right.
Now they have to have puns in a desperate attempt to keep up with the rising tide of humor everywhere in the culture.
You give the example of seeing a lost cat poster.
In my neighborhood here in Seattle, there was a lost cat poster. The cat was named Bon Jovi. And as a result, the please bring me back my cat if you see him poster was not a heartfelt plea. It was a jokey catalog of Bon Jovi lyrics.
Yeah.
I guess in hopes that that would be more effective. People would be better at cat hunting if they were humming the haunting poetry of John Bon Jovi in their head.
Because it's like you have to engage your audience, and that's what engages, or at least we think it does now.
Everything is funny, things that are sincere seem kind of stodgy and old-fashioned by comparison. Nobody wants that.
Yes. And why did this happen? Why did comedy take over?
Well, it's driven by a few things. It's driven by technology, for one thing. You know, we all have a phone in our pocket that can deliver us now hundreds of jokes a second through the endlessly scrolling social media feeds.
Yeah.
But honestly, I don't think it was organic. Like, if I had to point to one root thing, it would be powerful people and organizations realizing that comedy was effective. Advertising agencies used to think that funny ads didn't work because people would remember the funny ad, the funny punchline, but forget the product, you know?
We have to tell them all the reasons why the product is superior, and they'll remember that and make a purchasing decision.
You have little tiny text about how Arm & Hammer baking soda is so much better than whatever other brand of baking soda.
Right.
And now that kind of commercial is just gone. It's just kind of endless jokey sketches that... absurdist sketches that some ad agency hopes will go viral.
Well, I have to play the prime example of that, which is the Old Spice man.
Old Spice guy. They got tens of millions of people to watch this ad for free. They didn't have to pay a penny. People sought this out.
Okay. Can we bring up, while we talk, maybe I'll try to bring up Old Spice guy. But that ad, it's great that you brought it up because it was... The entire ad was surreal and absurd, and you even talk about how the product, its packaging, everything, it's like it's not a deodorant, it's an entertainment brand.
Procter & Gamble told their Portland ad agency, Old Spice is not a deodorant anymore. It's an entertainment brand. Like the fact that it supports a deodorant is almost incidental now. It's just a vehicle for making people feel good when they click on something on the internet, and... we'll probably sell some deodorant, too.
You go back over time in the book. I think of the Middle Ages as having been unfunny, but do we know that that's true?
There's no written record of humor, but that appears to be by design. For many years, the church was not an instrument of humor. They frowned on joke telling in all its forms. You could get kicked out of your monastery if you made a fellow monk laugh,
uh-huh.
I guess with a funny sound effect at dinner or whatever, partly driven by the fact that in the Bible, Jesus is never said to laugh. So for many centuries, religious people assumed that that's not an accident. We should be suffering now so we can have happiness later in heaven.
Wait a minute, you mean Jesus was never said to laugh or Jesus was said to never laugh?
Jesus was never said to laugh. It's omission.
Okay.
Like nowhere in the scripture does it say, and Jesus did his famous thing where he did not laugh at a joke. There's just no scripture where
Not once with this guy. I knew him. Trust me. The man didn't laugh.
You could not crack him up. No, I mean, and there's, of course, there's no mention of him cleaning his teeth or you know, scratching the back of his head either. But
yeah, right.
These were taken as signs that it was more righteous to be sober-minded. And of course, laughing does kind of feel like it's a bodily explosion you can't really control. So there's something sensual about it.
Yes.
So I think that's the reason why there's no historical record, even though I'm sure people were telling jokes about, you know, fart jokes and horny damsels and whatever for centuries. We just don't know.
Right. Do you have a mental timeline of modern comedy? Like I think of Lenny Bruce and I think of, to me, Airplane. I saw Airplane when it came out in the theater and it was a revelation to me. And it was like, how can we not how can we ever go backward in joke density? Do you have in your mind moments of this changes everything?
Yeah, Airplane's a great example. You know, once a certain kind, you know, the mind is used to a certain kind of pace of jokes, you can't go backwards. You know, the pace of jokes in sitcoms, I calculated in the book, has more than doubled since the 50s. You know, more jokes per minute, more laughs per minute.
Yeah.
And it's the hedonic treadmill we're all on. We need more and more pleasurable stimulus just to avoid feeling unhappy. You know, we don't even get the same rise out of it anymore. I think there's some downsides to this new comedy density of our culture.
I marked the time when I realized I was unhip, but when I watched, and of course you always realize it late, so I was unhip much earlier, but I was watching early Arrested Development, and I knew it was clever, And very well done, and I recognized it as funny, but I didn't want to be in that. It seemed like, oh, I get it. Everybody's cynical and shallow, and I'm not truly deeply enjoying this.
This sensibility is not for me, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one. I think that's one cost of the new density of jokes and this incredibly kind of baroque complexity of these Arrested Development style jokes where you get callbacks six times and you get little in-jokes hidden in the background and even call forwards to things that haven't happened in the show yet, but
right.
Will. Like, comedy is full of these weird little Easter eggs now. And it's so far from, like, the kind of organic thing that really makes us laugh. It's kind of become its own arcane, almost arbitrary, self-sustaining thing where it's got to be newer and more difficult or else it seems, again, stodgy and old-fashioned.
Well, when I asked you why this has happened, why did comedy take over, you mentioned your phone and your Twitter feed, but you said also there's money in it. It was engineered. Corporations realize that humor works. But it's it's taken off since then, so that we're all yucking it up. And why do you think that has happened?
That's probably the participatory nature of social media, I think, is part of it. You know, there's a comment section, you know. Stand-up never had a comment section. Those were hecklers, and they got kicked out.
Right.
But today, we're all invited to riff along with whatever the meme of the day is or the funny Twitter joke. And also the sheer density. You see so many of these jokes get told, you know. Our parents or grandparents might have seen Johnny Carson tell 5 jokes a night, and that was it.
Right.
You know, we can see 5 jokes a minute and every time we look at our phones. The more you see, the more you start to see the mechanics. You start to see what the little tricks are, what the devices that make a joke work or not work. And we all become comedy writers, for better or for worse. Like, maybe we also become jaded and unentertainable like comedy writers, right?
Right. Yeah, comedy writers are not necessarily the most joyous people.
They're kind of, the Tina Fey quote is that a comedy fan likes to see an actor dressed as an old lady fall down a flight of stairs, but a comedy writer wants to see a real old lady pushed down a flight of stairs. And I think there's something to that.
Yeah, that gets to where you start to question. It's interesting in your book, you start to wonder whether this is actually making us happier people. I'm talking to Ken Jennings. You may know him best as the Jeopardy champion, but also a New York Times bestselling author, and his latest is Planet Funny, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. And can you admit in the book yourself to being a Twitter jokester, and how do you feel about that? You're part of this.
You know, I hope the book is a love letter to comedy, because I was like you, you know, class clown, loved staying up to watch Letterman.
How do you know I was a class clown?
I'm going to assume that you were a class clown. Am I wrong about this?
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, the feeling you get of having a secret from adults when you stay up to watch Letterman or SNL or something they don't get,
yeah.
That was a huge part of my growing up. But, you know, I see kind of this default voice of snark and irony that kind of suffuses our culture now. And the impulse I always have to just say something on Twitter, like, I don't exist if I don't think of some snarky take on the day's news story to put on Twitter right now.
Are you enjoying it?
Less and less. You know, like on some level, you like when it.
You're very funny, by the way, on Twitter. Like, genuinely. And I'm just. You have. I don't, how many followers on Twitter?
I don't know. 250,000.
250,000, because people find you hilarious. I just want to say, like, you are at the top of your game. You're in the Twitter pantheon, I would say, of funny people. So.
But that is kind of like being the best ballet dancer in Galveston, Texas, you know? Like, the real funny people, you know, are not just making jokes on Twitter. It's kind of a hobby for me to, you know, distract me from the stuff I'm supposed to be doing every day. But
well, that's interesting you say that, because I might have thought that the funniest, the height of comedy is Twitter, because that's where there's a comedy. David Letterman had a room of a dozen people or whatever, but Twitter is this the ultimate in comedy competition, and you're at the top of that. So I would have thought that makes you the funniest, or one of the funniest.
Maybe there's I just know I could never get up on a stage and do stand-up, which I know you have done.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, to me, that really is an art, and that terrifies me. I often feel like on Twitter, like I've learned a number of mechanisms or algorithms even that, you know, I've programmed myself into being kind of a funny person, but like I've missed the soul of it. And I don't find that having a quippy response to everything is necessarily a moral good in life. Like recently my daughter fell and broke her wrist, and Twitter really, you know, being in our funny culture really prepared me for that eventuality, for being able to kind of joke with her and distract her and jolly her along as she got her cast or whatever. But when things really go wrong, you know, I had a friend, not to bring down the room, but I had a friend like lose a kid in a car accident.
Yeah.
And I realized our kind of ironic culture had not prepared me for that moment. You know, I had nothing, you know, none of my kind of jovial, jolly riffs were up to the task.
Well, do you think that all the joking you've done has somehow made you callous to that? Insensitive?
I think it does. You know, when you see the kind of jokes people tell on Twitter, it is, like you say, a big joke contest, a writer's room the size of a planet, and they need new material. So every day, you know, let's say a celebrity dies, you will have thousands of funny people trying to come up with the best joke about the IKEA guy dying. Like, oh, I hope his coffin came with an Allen wrench, yeah. Or, you know.
When Princess Leia died, Cinnabon had that tweet about that she had the best buns in the galaxy.
Did they have to do that? I mean, it's not even a question of will that sell you more Cinnabons. It's like, why is that your first response to like a beloved actress dying? And I do kind of feel like it does make us callous if it teaches us that that should be our first response, have something to say at all costs.
Okay, in defense of Cinnabon, though, they could have said nothing at all. I guess that's the most obvious thing to do. But we don't really buy the thoughts and prayers thing anymore. Anyway, like, I don't believe that the Cinnabon Corporation necessarily is feeling sincerely tearful about Carrie Fisher dying. So, and I know that comedy sells stuff. I didn't feel coarsened by that. I just thought, okay, that's what Cinnabon does. That's not what that's not what my reaction has to be.
That's a fair point. I mean, every year on 9/11, you have to see how Jiffy Lube remembers 9/11 on Twitter or whatever.
Right.
And you see it in the Trump era as well, where formerly funny people on Twitter, you know, many keep, you know, telling kind of darker and darker jokes about unfunny times.
Mm-hmm.
Others kind of develop this other weird kind of sanctimonious voice, like, the Republic cannot stand if, you know, and saying all these kind of not very convincing. It's almost like the problem with Twitter is as much the brevity as anything else. You know, there's a few things it does well, but I don't know if earnestness is one of them.
You said something really interesting about as if you felt like you had figured out how to be funny. On Twitter, you had solved the puzzle.
I can simulate it, yeah.
You can simulate funny, but you don't know whether you're being genuinely funny.
I'm like Data on Star Trek, and I got a new chip in my head. And I honestly think that's what happens. And maybe that's the same process that organically makes a comedian funner. But we really can see a steroid version of it today, as the social media just pumps it into your veins.
Mm. The book, again, Planet Funny, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. The author is Ken Jennings, and you mentioned my stand-up comedy past. I feel like I read this book thinking, I am your walking example of this, because you talk about the comedy boom, which I remember well in the late 80s, right? All the observational humor, what's up with losing your socks in the dryer, that kind of stuff. And comedy had an explosion. Cable channels had something to do with that. And now there were lots of comedians, and they had stand-up specials. And I remember being working in journalism, and I was 22, whatever, and watching another terrible comedian and thinking, well, I'm funnier than that person. I could be that bad. And I quit my job in public radio in Florida and went to work in stand-up comedy. And I was I was that inoffensive, wry, observational guy, and I did fine, you know? I mean, I said some funny things. It was fun. But I was one year in a comedy competition with Patton Oswalt, who many of our listeners will know as an alt-comedy hero, and I was doing one thing, and the next wave was coming up behind me and passing me. It was like we were doing two different things. I was trying to please the judges in this comedy competition. Patton Oswalt was being surreal and doing, it was different every night, and I just eventually got out of it for that reason. Because, well, he's way more interesting than me.
I think one thing we have seen a lot today is that everyone's kind of internalized this voice of comedy, this kind of snarky approach, a way of constructing a sentence, a way of getting to a point. But it doesn't make us all artists. It doesn't make us all Patton Oswalt-level comedy geniuses. Mm-hmm. So we can all kind of do the voice, but sometimes you watch these funny online videos and you realize these sound like jokes, but there are really no jokes there. You know, we've all become comedy minor birds. We can mimic it, but we've missed like the soul of why people actually tell jokes, because they have a heartfelt point, because they really discovered something incongruous or interesting about the world that they wanted to share.
Yeah.
It's better if it comes from there, I think, and not just from mimicking the voice.
Well, then why are we rewarding those comedy mimickers so much? That seems to be, you know, you get a bunch of followers on Twitter. I think you're a pretty popular person around the office if you can be the funniest one in the right cubicle. So we seem to reward that.
There's a bottomless appetite for it, I guess, is what I would say. I mean, our brains evolved to see humor probably as a way of solving little evolutionary puzzles. You know, if you could see a little incongruity in life and figure out why it was a puzzle and explain it, you were going to survive better than the person who just never understood why they tripped over the vine.
Right.
Whatever. And so we have this deep need in our head to find these puzzles and solve them, and life just doesn't offer as many of them anymore. So we have to create these little situations, these little artificial situations, which are jokes. We've got this hardwired need to discover jokes in our environment. And I think that's what keeps upping the ante and upping the density in life. You don't want to spend 8 hours of your day at a job with no jokes. So you look for the guy in the cubicle that can do the Borat voice, or maybe even worse, your boss is like doing funny memos and, you know, funny office gimmicks, you know, dressed like Elvis Day or Funny Shoes Day or...
That's what she said.
Exactly. Corporate humor. Oh. And it doesn't even need to be good. It just we just need to have more of it.
Ken Jennings, by the way, is speaking tonight at the Elliott Bay Book Company with his new book, Planet Funny. I get the... we probably evolve to notice life's little hiccups because we want to solve hiccups and survive. So Jerry Seinfeld noticed hiccups. But how does that explain the turning a joke on itself? That is a huge thing now, is that you've got to be truly funny, you have to be meta funny. You have to be commenting on the very joke that you're making.
I think that's one sign of a savvier audience. You know, before it would just be the comedy writers that could understand jokes on a joke. They could see the joke they weren't making or the other joke they were referring to. Mm-hmm. Today, now that we're all comedy writers, we can all tell when a sitcom makes a joke and then somebody else jokes the joke. Or somebody tells kind of a...
What would be an example of that? Does something come to mind?
You know, you could say it, you could tell a joke like, did you hear about the archaeologist whose career was in ruins? His wife left him and his university fired him. You know, or right. Something like that, where it relies on you knowing what the original joke is and then seeing a comedian not make that joke, doing something darker or weirder.
Yes.
Or just Steve Martin, you know, getting up on stage in 1970 and doing a whole routine that's really just kind of putting on comedy. Like it sounds like he's doing comedy, but he's just kind of, he's talking about how he's going to do jokes. He brings on a banjo, but never plays it. He says his catchphrases, but ironically.
Right.
You know, like we all understand comedy so well, we laugh at simulations of it.
So then if we are now joking about the joke, what is the future of comedy? Where do we go from that?
I feel like a singularity is approaching because it can't get much denser or more sophisticated.
Or faster paced or, absurdist. Yeah.
I think we're going to hit hard limits the way, you know, they keep saying microchip speeds might hit a hard limit where the laws of the universe will kick in and the chip can't get faster, the joke can't get faster, the sitcom can't get faster. And I don't know what happens then. It certainly bleeds into more areas of life, you know, areas that used to be sincere. We're going to have funny headstones, funny epitaphs, funny legal decisions.
Although funny headstones, that's not a completely new thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I've seen a headstone that says, you know, I told you I was sick, or, well, this sucks, or I'd rather be reading this. I've seen that on a headstone.
I've seen headstones in Comic Sans, and I always wonder if it's actually a joke or if it's a non-ironic use of a terrible
Depending
thing.
On the year. You have to look at the year,
exactly.
the second year that's printed.
And the first year. You have to know how old they were.
Yes.
A 90-year-old man is not using Comic Sans ironically.
Good point. So you seemed to, earlier, you were expressing some... concern about, you know, about whether this is making us better people. So we've known each other for a little bit, you know, we kind of socially, I remember the dinner was it a Greek restaurant or wherever we were? And I just remember when I'm with you, you're so clever and funny that I go into banter mode. Would you like to do you remember, you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
We've done fun banter, but Are you enjoying that? Would you like to get out of that game and just be, hey, let's talk sincerely.
Hey,
Ken, what's
Bill,
really going
Bill,
on?
Bill, how's it
you?
Going?
Yeah, no, really, how's it really going?
Tell me about your childhood.
Yeah.
I actually would. I see my son being sarcastic back to me because I have a teenage son now.
Yeah.
And I realize he's just learned to do that voice for me, and it's not as flattering as it sounds in my head when I do it. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like a great thing to be remembered as the funny guy, but... I just had this nightmarish idea of somebody eulogizing me and talking about how, he was always funny at dinner. Like, really? Like, I wouldn't choose that. Like, why don't they talk about how I was always so generous or sincere or compassionate? I mean, there's higher things to shoot for. It's not too late for me. I hope I can be saved, but there's always the siren song of the funny comment or the snide comeback, and it's hard to resist.
Well, they say that, I've heard that millennials, I think you quote a number, surveyed millennials who say they get their identity from their humor. But I do think of millennials as being super engaged. Now, maybe this is a Trump effect, but I mean, are you sure that we are becoming coarsened? Because you really can't do a lot of insulting humor, racist, sexist humor that you used to do. That's punching down. You get called out. Like, I guess I'm looking for signs hopeful signs that we're comedy saturated, but we're still I think of humans as getting better and better over time.
I think those are two very hopeful signs, you know, that we're telling better jokes, not just higher quality, less hacky ones, but less kind of dumb, edgy ones, you know, that have the wrong targets and get a cheap laugh. Like, I'm actually in favor, I'm 100% in favor of call-out culture in the book, which I think is maybe not going to be the most popular thing in it.
Especially among comics.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because I think comedians long had this exception, like, we are the nation's truth tellers. We need to be able to say whatever about taboo things, the first thing that comes into our head. And that's less convincing to me than ever when we're all joke tellers, you know? We all can't have that carve out. And then you mentioned the Trump era, which I think is kind of a product of this new comedy age. You know, you had him kind of doing his buffoonish thing at rallies and supporters reacting to him as if he were, as if they had just seen some kind of rage comic, you know, he says what we're all thinking.
Yes.
He goes there.
Yep.
And other people just discounting him on ironic grounds. Oh, he's just being Trump. He can't mean all those things he says. So this kind of, this little bump in actual sincerity and activism that's come after that, I don't think it's replaced comedy, but I like that it's colored comedy. I like that you can see a stand-up special by, like, somebody like Ahari Kondabolu now, you know, Seattle comic.
Yep.
And he will do 45 minutes of comedy about what it's like to be a brown person in America, or school vouchers, or school shootings, or whatever the issue is, and he's skilled enough to make them work at jokes, but the convictions are clear. To me, that's a very promising sign.
Yeah, John Oliver leaning into a topic and getting lots of laughs. Okay, well then let's watch comedy evolve together, okay? Well, I mean, we got to keep talking about this.
I think if people are aware, we can maybe inoculate ourselves against the worst excesses, but we just have to know it's going on, you know? I hope the book starts a conversation.
Excellent book. Thanks. It was a good read. Thanks, Ken.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Planet Funny is the book, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. And he'll be speaking tonight, Ken Jennings, at the Elliott Bay Book Company. What time do we know? 7 o'clock. Ken, will you stay here and keep talking about what's going on in the world with us?
I would be flattered.
On the record. Awesome. Stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Can a president pardon himself? A lawyer for President Trump, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, says, yep.
Do you and the president's attorneys believe the president has the power to pardon himself?
He's not, but he probably does. I mean, he has no intention of pardoning himself, but he probably does. It doesn't say he can't. I mean, that's another really interesting constitutional argument. Can the president pardon himself?
I think it's an open question?
I used to run the pardon attorney. It would be an open question. I think it would probably get answered by, gosh, that's what the Constitution says, and if you want to change it, change it. But, yeah.
That's Giuliani talking yesterday with ABC's George Stephanopoulos. This morning, President Trump was even more direct. He tweeted, in part, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon myself. But why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong? So, can a president pardon him or herself? With me on the phone, University of Washington Associate Law Professor Lisa Marshall Manheim. She is co-author of The Limits of Presidential Power, A Citizen's Guide to the Law. Welcome back to KUOW, Professor.
Thanks so much.
So the president says that numerous legal scholars say he has the absolute right to pardon himself. Is that true?
Well, there are plenty of legal scholars and lawyers who will take that position, but there's also plenty of scholars and lawyers who take the opposite position. So this is an area of the law where we just don't have a definitive answer, in part because the courts have not jumped in to decide this question.
Well, when Rudy Giuliani says it's in the Constitution, if you don't like it, change the Constitution, what about that?
Well, what he presumably was referring to was the constitutional language itself, which is ambiguous on this question. But it is phrased in a relatively broad manner. It says that the president shall have power to grant pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. So there's no language in the Constitution itself that limits the pardon power in a way that clearly indicates the president can't pardon himself.
But what about the except in the case of impeachment language?
Well, that's clear. So just so that we're all on the same page in terms of what President Trump is arguing and in terms of what his lawyer is arguing, they're arguing that the president could pardon himself when it comes to a criminal prosecution. When it comes to whether the president could somehow shield himself against impeachment and conviction, by the House and the Senate, there's no legal argument that he could do that. So even if he were to pardon himself, the Congress could still undertake impeachment proceedings, and if they convicted him through those proceedings, he would be removed from office.
Okay, we're talking about the claim that a president can pardon themselves in the matter of a criminal conviction. And why is this an unsettled question? Why isn't it clear?
Well, there's a couple reasons for that. One is that if you turn to the authorities we usually turn to get legal answers, those authorities just don't provide a clear answer here. So, again, the constitutional language itself isn't clear which way this comes out. We don't have court cases that resolve it one way or the other. We also don't have historical precedents where presidents have tried to do this, and then we've figured out that it should be resolved one way or the other. If the question is then, well, why don't we have a definitive answer in these sources we usually look to? Largely that's because traditionally in this country, presidents have tried to not push legal lines unless they feel like they really have to for some reason. And so, for example, President Nixon dealt with issues similar to this. There was a question of whether he could pardon himself for crimes that at the time had been quite fleshed out. There were people actually being prosecuted for crimes in which he was considered to be playing a part in those crimes. And tellingly, President Nixon and his lawyers apparently concluded that he did have the power to pardon himself. But nevertheless, he chose not to do it because he didn't want to push that legal line.
This is University of Washington Associate Law Professor Lisa Marshall Mannheim, co-author of The Limits of Presidential Power. Separate from the self-pardoning, Professor, there's the question of how much the president has to cooperate with a federal investigation. The special counsel, Robert Mueller, wants to interview the president. Does the president get to decide for himself whether to do that?
So that's a great question, and that's an area of the law where we have a little bit more of an answer, a legal answer, although it's still quite unsettled in terms of the details. So the most on-point case here is, again, involving President Nixon, where a prosecutor wanted President Nixon to turn over some tapes that related to the Watergate proceedings, and President Nixon didn't want to turn those over. And so that legal dispute went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court said essentially, yes, sometimes it is okay for a president to say no when a private person wouldn't be able to say no. But in this particular case, the importance of these criminal proceedings are so high, and these were criminal proceedings with respect to other people. They said the importance of the criminal proceedings is so high that President Nixon, you don't have a privilege here. You are not able to withhold these tapes. So the Supreme Court actually told President Nixon that he was required under the Constitution to turn those tapes over.
Finally, Professor, are we heading for a constitutional crisis here?
Well, I don't know. I can't predict the future, of course. The way I think of a constitutional crisis is when you have some really big legal or political issue that needs to be resolved, but that the Constitution itself doesn't resolve. So a quintessential example of this would be if a court issued an order telling the president to do something, but then the president refused to do it. It's just the Constitution doesn't have an answer for what happens in that situation. So I don't know if we're headed to that, but I will say the more willing the president and others are to push these legal limits, the higher likelihood that we'll get there.
Lisa Marshall Mannheim, Associate Professor of Law, University of Washington, co-author of the book The Limits of Presidential Power, A Citizen's Guide to the Law. Professor, thanks a lot for being on KUOW.
Thank you.
More of The Record in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. North Korea, Roseanne, presidential obstructions. You might have heard some headlines about those topics over the weekend. We have a few stories that maybe you didn't hear. I'm joined by our weekly panel to recap their favorite or most compelling stories of the weekend. Eric Hanberg is author and commissioner on the Metro Parks Board of Tacoma. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
Ruchika Altushyan is author of The Diversity Advantage, Fixing Gender Inequality in the Workplace. Welcome, Ruchika.
Thank you.
And Ken Jennings is still with us, Jeopardy winner, Jeopardy champ, author of Planet Funny. Thanks for hanging with us, Ken.
Still here.
So let's start with stories that most interested you. Eric, your top story you call hashtag Cockygate.
Yeah, hashtag Cockygate is happened when a romance writer named Felina Hopkins, she put out a series of books about, cocky senator, cowboy, Cocky Heart Surgeon, and this is a series of romance books. And she got that trademarked, the Cocky Brothers series. But then she started sending cease and desist letters to other, you know, the author of Cocky Fiance and things like that. And suddenly Amazon was taking down other titles because it had the word cocky in it. And the Romance Writers Association stepped in, the Authors Guild stepped in, and on Friday there was a hearing about this, and the judge did not think very highly of her arguments. But it's pretty funny to read the transcript of this as the judge is trying to understand, well, what do we mean by cocky? And, you know, he isn't wearing a shirt, but he has a stethoscope. Does that mean he's a doctor? her argument didn't hold a lot of water, and it seems like...
Well, what did the case turn on? Why did the judge say?
Well, it comes down to you can't trademark a book title. You can trademark a book series.
What about copyright? Is that possible?
There's so many puns to be had in this situation, but you can't do that. And she was probably, in the words of one lawyer, even using trademark bullying. This always gets my goat a little bit because, you know, like Super Bowl, you know, I can't have a Super Bowl party without someone coming after me, or the Oscar party. But in this case, this is one where it seems like common English words should not be able to be copywritten. And it seems like the judge is going with that.
See, I did the thing, Ken. Mm-hmm. I had to make a joke.
It was
like the premise was
copyright,
but it was just a pun. But the premise was potentially funny. And like if someone had to satisfy that. Ken and I were talking earlier about comedy taking over our culture.
You made thousands of people laugh out in Radio Land.
I could have done so much better. Twitter, I would have crafted it on Twitter. Any other reaction to Cockygate?
The series is called The Cocky Brothers?
It's the Cocker Brothers, like the Cocky series.
So are they all brothers? The heart surgeon is brother to the pilot?
Cocky cowboy, to the cocky senator.
What a wacky family.
They're very cocky.
That's a crazy family, these guys.
So now, just to be clear, if I wrote my next book, it could have cocky in the title.
I think you're covered. This is how it seems, right?
You're good.
I'm excited to hear that.
Speaking of romance, Ruchika, you have been thinking about Pride Month, which started last Friday in Seattle, and kind of contrasting that with the Singapore of your childhood.
That's right. So I grew up in Singapore, and we certainly did not have a Pride Month, although we've had different entities trying to bring some sort of march and some sort of celebration of same-sex couples and relationships. But yeah, growing up in Singapore, where series like Will and Grace were actually banned because Will is gay, and just not having that in our common lexicon, not really talking about, you know, LGBTQ issues or challenges or even same-sex marriage even being a thing. It still isn't. And now meeting so many Seattleites who are originally from Singapore who actually moved here, you know, so that they could have their marriage, you know, so that they could have a marriage and they could have children. And just moving to this like liberal West Coast, but also the United States being really open-minded about this as a concept. And then seeing the Supreme Court sort of decision this morning, it was really, really disheartening to see.
Which decision are you referring to?
So in Colorado, a baker was actually allowed to not serve and not prepare a cake for a same-sex, a gay wedding. And to see that decision being made was really, really disheartening because a lot of us, especially immigrants, people like me who come in here from Singapore, we're really excited about the idea that you really can be who you want to be and certainly have your views and yourself be respected. And then to have this be a reality here in the United States can feel like a big blow.
And there's a Washington State florist with a similar case who didn't want to do a gay wedding. So in Singapore, you're saying publicly these questions of sexuality and gender possibilities, they're not officially discussed, but how does that affect the private experience and discussion of them?
I think it's really hard for people, for couples who actually want to live in Singapore and want to be recognized. There's actually no legal way that their couplehood is recognized. It's very, very tricky if they have children. And that's
the public end
right,
of it. Yeah.
Right, absolutely. Privately, I mean, these conversations happen. I mean, in any sort of arena where there is oppression, there is going to be a private way for these views to be expressed, and that very much exists. But just seeing people feel so oppressed, literally having to hide a side of their lives as they go into work, as they go out and meet other people, it's really, really disheartening to see. And seeing this become a thing in the United States, you know, in some ways it looks like we're actually taking steps backward is really, really concerning to me. But at the same time, Pride Month, you know, so I'm excited about that. So.
And Ken Jennings, we're talking about stories that were came up over the weekend for us, and you've been following the disappearance of Melania Trump.
The non-story.
The non-story.
It's the absence of a story.
Which is in itself
it's a story.
Remarkable.
Like, I grew up with these, like, you know, Time Life Mysteries of the Unexplained books, and I love a good disappearance. Like, it's, you know, where's Amelia Earhart? Or, like, where's Jimmy Hoffa? Like, now I'm like, well, where's Melania Trump? Like, this is the best one of these ever. She's the first lady, and nobody's seen her in 3 weeks.
And the White House says she's going to appear this evening at a ceremony?
But with no press, so I don't know.
I thought there was a journalist that saw her a couple days ago.
Yeah, two journalists said they passed her in the hall. So that opens up all kinds of conspiracy theories. You know, why is she in the hall but not making public appearances? Could it be a lookalike? I love all these theories.
Hey, by the way, she was on Twitter, so doesn't that mean that she actually
in the voice of Donald Trump?
Yeah, so my wife Melania is fine. Like, the initial letters do say, please help me, which is very upsetting, but
oh, my husband did not dictate this, and that's sad that you would ask. So one more story I wanted to bounce off you. The Baltimore Public Libraries have announced they're getting rid of overdue book fines. The new policy will erase $186,000 in penalties and reinstates membership for 13,000 borrowers whose cards have been blocked. However, the library will still charge for books that are never returned. The library will lose the roughly $100,000 fines it collects a year. Presumably, that can go to great library programs for the community. What do you think of the Baltimore move? Would you want to see that replicated here in the Seattle area?
I'll go first. I'm really excited about this, and I would love to see it happen. We know that these sorts of fines and things like that are a barrier that impact low-income, often communities of color. And for me, I mean, libraries was such a big part of my childhood and growing up and knowledge sharing. In today's world, in the digital age, it's a great meeting spot. I mean, I love the downtown public library, the Central Lending Library.
But wasn't an overdue book also part of your childhood experience?
No, I was always on time.
I say call it a marketing expense because it's worth it to get people back and using the library again. They're so vitally needed right now.
So no one's going to defend the library fine, the overdue fine.
One thing I love about the library fines is you get these great stories where a book from 1896 is returned and you can be like, my great-great-grandfather now owes $67,000. Like, I mourn the loss of this kind of news story, which I deeply love.
Right. Those people get thrown into debtor's prison, right?
Well, 13,000 of them apparently is such scofflaws they can't use the Baltimore Library anymore. I can't believe that there's so many of these things.
Let them back in, that's what I say.
We called up the Seattle Public Library. In 2017, they collected not $186,000, $1 million in overdue fines from patrons. Again, left on the table. Let me make the case this way. It is the ultimate user fee. You are charging someone who has benefited from the service of the public library, who did not return the book. Who better to raise money for important community programs than that person?
The Snohomish County Library here does the same thing. They do not enforce fines, and they say that they save more in not having an enforcement mechanism than they would make from the fines. I don't know if that would
be true. There's a conservative, you know, economic argument.
Right. Small government and small libraries. That's what we want.
But what about the responsibility it taught us?
I'm happy to pay my fine, but if, you know, every 5 years a library wants to wipe the slate clean, I think that's a good service.
Yeah, and jokes aside, I mean, it's great to have this conversation, but imagine, you know, the libraries is, and for a lot of families, it is your only way of access to books, right? So the argument changes if we're kind of talking about, you know, someone who's trying to skirt the fines just because they can't be bothered versus someone for whom that access would actually matter.
That's what we need to do, is figure out, technology's got to help us figure out which are the people who just are scofflaws and no goodniks. And just charge those people.
I want technology to trace the books my kids check out so I know, like, where in my daughter's closet this overdue book is. Like,
Put a chip in it.
Why do these books not have chips? That's what
the amount of time I have spent trying to find the book. That's a really good call.
How about Netflix for books? Libraries can just ship us the books and it'd be perfect.
Right.
I think there is something like, or that's more for ebooks, which, by the way, is a whole different conversation.
We're talking with our guest, our panel this week of, you know, weekend watchers, Ruchika Tulshyan. She just gave me the thumbs up for the finally arriving at that pronunciation. Author of The Diversity Advantage, Fixing Gender Equality in the Workplace. And Eric Hanberg, author and commissioner on the Metro Parks Board of Tacoma. And Ken Jennings, Jeopardy Dominator and author of Planet Funny, How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. Thanks, everybody, for sitting in. Good to see you.
Thank you.